Donald Trump opens the government with no wall. Roger Stone insists he's not a crook. And there's grounds for divorce between Howard Schultz and the Democrats. It's a grande edition of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Democrats look up Howard Schultz in the dictionary and see a picture of Ralph Nader.
When you lose Florida by 534 votes, and Ralph Nader got 100,000 votes, it is hard to make the case that Nader did not cost Gore the presidency. So that's their nightmare.
Plus, what will it take for a Republican to challenge President Trump for renomination next year?
To make a viable race, you need to raise money. So unless there is a Republican billionaire out there willing to run on his or her own, really hard to see how somebody can make a truly effective race in the presidential primaries.
And we'll hear about a new book that explores the history of the Brown family dynasty in California. It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 262 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Well, our long national nightmare, the one lasting 35 days, is over. President Trump, having shut down the government because Congress wouldn't go along with his plan to fund a wall on the border with Mexico, realized he was playing with a losing hand. His numbers were collapsing. A vote in the Senate on a Democratic bill to reopen the government with no wall funding attracted 6 Republican votes, which was alarming to the GOP leadership. And then there was this staffing shortage at LaGuardia Airport that threatened the safety in the skies. And so the shutdown is over, at least until February 15th. By then, we'll see if the two sides manage to come up with a compromise. Otherwise, the nightmare starts all over again. And the State of the Union is back on for this coming Tuesday. It's unlikely we'll have a deal on the border funding by then, so it'll be interesting to hear what the president has to say. And Stacey Abrams, last year's unsuccessful Georgia gubernatorial candidate, will be giving the Democratic response. Many in the party are excited about giving Abrams that role, but she shouldn't forget that the failures of those who gave their response in the past are remembered far more than the successes. Like when Marco Rubio struggled to reach for a water bottle in 2013 in the middle of his remarks.
In the short time that I've been here in Washington, nothing has frustrated me more than false choices like the one the president laid out tonight. The choice isn't just between big government or big business. What we need is an accountable, efficient, and effective government.
There was also Bobby Jindal's awkward and badly staged message in 2009.
Good evening and happy Mardi Gras. I'm Bobby Jindal, governor of Louisiana. Tonight, we witnessed a great moment in the history of our republic. In the very chamber where Congress once voted to abolish slavery, our first African-American president stepped forward to address the state of our union.
I still can't forget Tim Kaine's distracting eyebrows in 2006. And why was Governor Bill Clinton speaking over Genesis with his response to President Reagan in 1985?
Speaking for the Democratic Party tonight will be Governor Bill Clinton of Arkansas.
These Americans were chosen from across our nation. They are expressing themselves about Democrats, Republicans, and the part government plays in their lives. And they express their hopes and fears, their values, and their vision for the future.
In any event, we'll see if Abrams can break that curse. She's said to be seriously considering a run for the Senate next year against Republican incumbent David Perdue. We'll see if Tuesday's address helps or hurts. Meanwhile, there seems to be as much attention on the candidates who say they aren't running for president as for those who are. The latest no-go, Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti on Tuesday.
And finally, I also know that the two things I love the most, my family and my city, are right here in LA. So I've decided not to throw my hat into the ring to run for president in 2020.
And that leads to this week's trivia question. Though some have tried, no one has ever gone directly from the mayor's office to the White House. But what sitting mayor got the most primary votes in his or her bid for the presidency? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned. You know the reaction among Democrats when you mention the name Ralph Nader? Well, quadruple that, and you kind of get their mood after they watched Howard Schultz on 60 Minutes last Sunday.
I am seriously thinking of running for president. I will run as a centrist independent outside of the two-party system.
Schultz, the billionaire founder and former CEO of Starbucks, has been hinting about a presidential bid for months. He is quite anti-Trump, but while he identifies himself as a Democrat, he doesn't sound like a big fan of how he sees the direction of his party.
I look at both parties. We see extremes on both sides. Well, we are sitting today with approximately $21.5 trillion of debt, which is a reckless example, not only of Republicans, but of Democrats as well, as a reckless failure of their constitutional responsibility.
Aren't you worried, asked 60 Minutes Scott Pelley, that you might split the anti-Trump vote and help reelect the president?
I want to see the American people win. I want to see America win. I don't care if you're Democrat, independent, libertarian, Republican, bring me your ideas, and I will be an independent person who will embrace those ideas because I am not in any way in bed with a party.
Schultz may not be worried, but Democrats certainly are. They've gone apoplectic in the past few days over the thought of this guy splitting the anti-Trump vote. They remind Schultz about the lessons of 2000 and the widely held view that Ralph Nader's candidacy, especially in states like Florida and New Hampshire, helped elect George W. Bush. There are even those who are threatening a nationwide boycott of Starbucks. Carl Cannon is the Washington bureau chief of Real Clear Politics and has been watching all the brouhaha. Carl, welcome back to the Political Junkie.
How have you been, Ken?
Well, I think maybe better than Howard Schultz lately, because he has been besieged with protests and complaints, and basically it's been pretty astonishing watching the Democrats tear themselves into knots about a potential Schultz candidacy.
You know, some of this is predictable, and whichever political party thinks they'll be disadvantaged by an independent always attacks the independent as a spoiler. You mentioned Ralph Nader. You know, there are still Democrats. You can't even say it over the radio. Ralph Nader's name is always preceded by adjectives or adverbs, some of which are anatomically impossible, because Ralph Nader is blamed by Democrats for costing Al Gore the 2000 election. Now, why is he blamed? Because, you know, we know that third-party candidates, it's not a one-to-one thing. Intuitively think, oh, if a person voted for Ralph Nader, they would have voted for Al Gore. Turns out it's not quite how it works. It's not even close to how it works. Half those people wouldn't have voted at all. You know, one or two out of the remaining five would have voted for Bush, and then the rest would have voted for Gore. But when you lose Florida by 534 votes, and Ralph Nader got 100,000 votes, it is hard to make the case that Nader did not cost Gore the presidency. So that's their nightmare. There are reasons for Democrats to worry, but the way they reacted to Schultz was so out. To me, it was disproportionate. I mean, you know, Jay Inslee, it'd be inexcusable if Howard Schultz helped Trump get elected. Mike Bloomberg, you know, he went on and on about how terrible this was. But people, we need to stop and take a deep breath. Let's start with Bloomberg. He was urged to run last time.
As an independent.
Yeah, or a Democrat. But as an independent, he looked at it. And he said, well, I didn't go because I thought it would help, you know, I thought if I ran, Hillary Clinton would lose. Well, that reminds me of the great Mark Hatfield line. He was an anti-war Republican from Oregon in after the 1964 debacle for his party. He had this quip. He said, they told me if I voted for Goldwater in 64 that we'd have more war and higher prices. Well, I did, and we do. You remember that?
I do remember that one.
Yeah, so Bloomberg said, I thought if I'd have run, Trump would have been elected president. Well, guess what? He was elected president.
Without him running. But here's the thing. Remind us, I mean, before we go about what effects they may have on affecting other candidates, but remind us about all the independent and third-party candidates who argued that the American people would come to their senses and elect them president because the Democrats are too liberal and the Republicans are too conservative, and they're right in the middle where the American people are.
Well, look, it's always been a pipe dream. Ken, and you and I know this. There's a reason this two-party system has lasted as long as it has. But, you know, let's be fair to the independents here. We've never had the two parties polarized in this way. And it's worse now than it was last year at this time, and it was worse last year than the year before. We have finally gotten, you know, a system that's more like European parliamentary systems. You know, if you're a conservative nowadays, you are in the Republican Party. If you're a liberal, you're in the Democratic Party. Now, that's just, you know, there's exceptions, but very few. And, you know, when I grew up, when I began covering politics, this wasn't true. You had Southern Democrats and you had liberal Republicans from the Northeast and libertarian Republicans from the far West. But they're all, it's polarized now. And I don't mean in a bad way I'm using that word. I don't mean rude talk on cable television. I'm talking about literally polarized. The Democrats, on any issue you can name, are more liberal than they've ever been. Same with the Republicans, more conservative than they've ever been. And there's a reason 43% of Americans don't identify with either of these parties. Now, they're not all centrist. Some of them, you know, are to the left of the Democratic Party. Some of the people on the right are even, you know, they're just not conservative enough for them. Some are just people don't pay any attention. But there is a sizable number of people, 10 million, 20 million, well-informed moderates who think that the two parties don't speak for them. This guy is proposing to speak for them. The problem for Democrats is, although we may have a European style in how we're ideologically aligned, we don't have a parliamentary system. It's winner-take-all. And so what they're worried is that a centrist will carry a few states, purple states, Virginia, let's just throw that out, and Colorado and North Carolina and Maine, and then the Electoral College will again go to Donald Trump even while he's losing the popular vote. That's a legitimate concern. But I'd expect Democrats to be more small D Democrats at this time in our history. I'd expect them to say, look, the guy has a right to run. You know, of course he does, because that's what I believe. Howard Dean said this. You know, last I checked, it's a free country. If he wants to run, he should run. And I thought, I wish more Democrats would say that, because I think that serves them better in the long run.
Well, you know that certainly if there's one guy who definitely wants them to run, it's the president of the United States. He had this tweet. Howard Schultz doesn't have the guts to run for president. I watched him on 60 Minutes last night, and I agree with him that he's not the smartest person. Besides, America already has that. I'm not sure he was talking about. Maybe he was talking about Mike Pence. But the point is, he's trying to goad him into the race. Obviously, Trump knows as well as anybody that somebody who's identified himself as a Democrat his whole life and probably has center-left positions on many issues would obviously hurt the Democratic Party. But here's the other question, though. Can an independent win? In other words, if the Schultz argument is that, well, Democrats are moving too far to the left, and they are moving far to the left, and Trump is too controversial, and he is controversial, and the Republicans are moving to the right, thus the middle is open for the taking. On paper, it seems like there's some reality there, on paper.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Look, Ken, if he's simply a spoiler, if this thing played out the way Jay Inslee and Bloomberg feared it was, obviously that Democrats are going to be miserable, and you know, a plurality, maybe if not an outright majority of Americans are going to be miserable. But what if he wins? That's a whole other thing, because then you'd have a chance to break the gridlock in Washington. You break this monopoly of the duopoly, if you will. It'd be an exciting time in American politics, and I just don't understand why. I'm looking at my old BlackBerry on my desk here as I talk to you on a Polycom desk phone, and I got my iPhone over here. I don't know why I can have three smartphones and a choice of 15 of them if I go to the store, but only two political parties in a country of 340 million people. It strikes me as lunacy. Having another 4 years of Trump would be a steep price to pay, can I grant you? But it may be time to break up the duopoly.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still shaking by the fact that you still have a BlackBerry.
I've dropped this thing, stepped on it, run over my car. You can't kill it. Somebody pays the bill. I don't know who. So at my company, I guess. So it works. So I keep it.
Okay, but going back to the third party candidates, and I know we were switching back and forth between Schultz and the history of third party candidates, but that's fine. But it reminds me a little bit of Ross Perot, and I'll tell you. Although you know the difference, I think, is Schultz is from Earth. But another difference is, here's the thing. Perot got a record 19 million votes. I think he spent a record $60 million on his campaign as well. But he won no electoral votes. So unless you're a George Wallace when you have great regional appeal, independents don't win states. They just don't.
Well, look, you're right. But let's stay with Ross Perot for a minute. Because when Perot was leading the field, he abruptly dropped out. He gave a reason that he dropped out, that he thought George H.W. Bush had spying on his daughter's wedding.
I know, like
he was hearing vibrations
through his fillings.
I always thought took him as a serious person, but suddenly he was talking like one of these protesters in Lafayette Park who wears tinfoil on the head. And then he got back in belatedly. He didn't spend the money. After he showed that he wasn't all right, that he wasn't sound, he got nearly 20% of the vote. If he had stayed in, remember he hired Ed Rollins, Reagan's campaign manager from 84, and Jody Powell, Ham Jordan from Carter. So he had this bipartisan appeal, and he had pros like Donald Trump. He wouldn't listen to the pros. But if he had run a professional campaign, that 1992 was a year, and maybe 2020 is like that, when all the stars and moons and planets are lined up, and you could have had an independent. And I submit to you that Ross Perot killed a movement rather than started it. And so are we at that inflection point again in our history? I'd hope so. Look, these Democrats who are complaining, what they really, if you got them alone in a bar and bought them a drink and said, calm down, doesn't the guy have a right to run? They'd say what I just said. They'd say, yeah, of course he does. But what if he helps Donald Trump? They are so afraid of a second Trump presidency, and they think it's too big a price to pay. And maybe it is too big a price to pay for the risk. But I still think, first of all, the guy certainly has the right to run, and he shouldn't be shamed out of running. And you know, we're 2 years out. If he was in the debates and he caught fire and suddenly he was leading in the polls, maybe the Democrat would pull out and endorse him. Or if he didn't get traction, maybe he could pull out. You don't know. You know, these campaigns have dynamics, and when you have three people, everything changes. That was what happened in '92. You know, George H.W. Bush was a very popular president. He was at 90% in a job approval rating in the Gallup poll, a number never attained by a president previously.
In 1991.
Yeah, never attained previously by a president. But suddenly he had these two guys chipping at him, and it was two against one. And Bush kind of appreciated Clinton's political talent. He couldn't figure Perot out at all. He was contemptuous of him. It all showed. The dynamic was a mess for Bush. And in that great debate, he suddenly looks at his watch like he has somewhere more important to be.
Get me out of here, right.
It's like the irritation. And the voters turn the page. But again, if you have a three-person race, if you have Kamala Harris, let's say, or an attractive new face in the Democratic Party, you have Donald Trump running as an independent, this angry, you know, caustic guy who calls people names, and a person comes up in the middle and says, you know what, I don't want any part of this. I don't want the far-left policies of the Democratic Party. I don't want whatever the Republicans are doing to themselves with Trump. I want a new comedy, C-O-M-I-T-Y, in this country, and I'm the guy to deliver it. Why wouldn't he catch fire?
But here's the other argument. Let's say first of all, to get on the ballot in all 50 states, he can't wait until 2020. He has to start the groundwork now. What if Joe Biden, who's not a far left Democrat, I mean, maybe he's maybe even two centers for some Democrats' taste, but what if Joe Biden turns out to be the Democratic nominee and Howard Schultz is already running and you have two kind of centrist Democrats running? I don't know. It just seems like, everybody agrees that he has the right to run. I still think that Democrats, I mean, the fact that they're still talking about, you know, setting fire to Starbucks around the country, they are just besides themselves over this. It's really beyond comprehension.
The left is angry in this country, and some of these people are bored trust fund goofballs who have nothing better to do, and some of them are really committed social justice people who think that Trump set the country back. I mean, they're all kind of motivations. But anger at a guy for running, it doesn't show me that he shouldn't run. It shows me why we need somebody like that in the arena. I mean, it is time. This system needs to be shaked up, but it's not necessarily the way the resistance thinks it needs to be shaked up. I mean, maybe we need more profound change than just getting rid of the incumbent president.
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying, and there are still those people who say Ralph Nader, you know, was you know, there wasn't a dime's difference between Bush and Gore in 2000, but explain that to a Democrat who watched the next 8 years of George W. Bush. They're still blaming Ralph Nader, and I suspect they'll blame Howard Schultz for a long time. So what does your gut tell you he's going to do? I mean, I've already seen an event he did on Sunday night when he was called out with an obscenity by someone in the audience. Crowds are going to be, you remember in 68, I don't know if you're about my age, you know, about mid-30s. Do you remember back, you know, in 68, wherever Hubert Humphrey went, he was booed and pelted and there were demonstrations against him. I suspect that wherever Howard Schultz goes, he'll get the same kind of reception.
I fear that that's right, Ken. The problem with that is that it's a bank shot, but in a way that would help Donald Trump. The way those Senate Judiciary Committee members treated Brett Kavanaugh and the way they allowed the hearings to be disruptive by organized protest did not reflect well on them.
Yeah, I don't know if I agree with you on that.
With swing voters. And if the Democratic Party decides it's the party of the mob, that it has to tolerate this kind of behavior to not turn off its base, that's going to be the Tea Party times three, man. That's going to make Trump look reasonable by comparison. And that's the last thing that we should want to be trying to do. So my guess is that if he's running, what you say would happen. My guess also is that, you know, there's no reason, I'm not saying Trump's right about Schultz, but there's nothing in his past that makes you think he wants to put up with that kind of abuse. But if he's chased out of the race by hecklers, I think that says something about our country that wouldn't be good.
You know, whatever happens, obviously, a lot of people are excited and agitated, and I guess we just have to wait till it all pans out. But it's going to be, just as 2016 was fascinating, 2020 is going to be no less fascinating.
I agree with you. And I still think the majority of Americans want an aspirational candidate. 2016 was an aberration. You had two unpopular nominees. I think that if the Democrats nominate somebody people like and are enthusiastic about, they don't need to worry so much who's running as a third party. They just need to get their people out, and they need to remind people of why their lives would be better if a Democrat's in the White House. And I think if they concentrate on that, they'll be okay.
Carl Cannon is the Washington Bureau Chief of Real Clear Politics. Carl, thanks so much.
All right, pal.
This statement from Donald Trump, made in 2016, has long been considered a truism.
The people, my people are so smart. And you know what else they say about my people? The polls. They say, I have the most loyal people. Did you ever see that? Where I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and I wouldn't lose any voters, okay? It's like incredible.
Now, maybe not. The president took a hit in the polls for his stewardship of the 35-day government shutdown, a tactic that didn't get him the $5.7 billion from Congress for his beloved wall. Some polls, not all, but some show erosion from his base, not to mention the mediocre approval he's getting from everywhere else. So does that mean a Republican challenger for 2020 is on the horizon? I think it's clear that former Ohio Governor John Kasich is planning to run. In fact, he doesn't seem to have stopped running since his 2016 bid. And as for Jeff Flake, the recently retired Arizona senator, he was thought to be testing the waters for the past year as well. But he had this to say Tuesday on CBS This Morning.
I do hope that there is a Republican who challenges the president in the primary. I still hope that somebody does. But that somebody won't be me. I will not be a candidate.
Flake, who was signed on as a CBS News consultant, added this.
The RNC and the president's campaign are now melded. They're trying to do everything they can to squelch any opposition. I still hope that some, and some are still talking about it, do run. I think that that's healthy. And I'm not a fan of this president, but that won't be me.
But the effort continues. In the past 2 weeks, both Stephen Hayes in a Washington Post op-ed and Brett Stevens, a New York Times columnist, made the case for a Republican challenger to step forward. History, of course, shows that it's nearly impossible to topple an incumbent president from within the party. But with Trump's approval numbers low and with the possibility of a bombshell from Robert Mueller, would it be a fool's errand? Jack Pitney is a politics professor at Claremont McKenna College who specializes in Republican Party politics. Jack, it's great having you back on the program.
Thank you very much.
Well, whenever a president gets into hot water, and if I may mix a metaphor, it might be fair to say that Trump has been skating on thin ice from day one. But whenever a president shows weakness in his first term, there's always talk about a challenger for the nomination. Jimmy Carter had Ted Kennedy, George Bush had Pat Buchanan. But it's one thing to take on a president, it's another to beat him.
That's right. It's one of these scenarios that political junkies live for, defeating a president in a nomination contest, a hung electoral college, a brokered convention. I would love, just from the standpoint of being a political junkie, I would love to see one of these things one day, but the odds are very much against it. And in the case of a successful primary challenge, extremely unlikely. Now, that doesn't mean that somebody won't try, but the odds are very, very steep.
And to make it more difficult, I mean, until recently, Trump had more party support than any Republican president other than George W. Bush after 9/11.
That's right. And even in the most recent Gallup poll, he's at 88% approval among Republicans. Now, there are other polls indicating that some Republicans might be open to a primary challenge, but that's in the abstract, not necessarily support for an actual flesh and blood opponent. So I'd be kind of skeptical about the prospects, although from the standpoint of democracy and the standpoint of principle, it might indeed be healthy for someone to come forward.
I mean, I know that Trump did take a hit with the shutdown. I know I saw that in many polls, his numbers, especially among Republicans, did shrink. But we have no idea if that's still going to be an issue next year.
That's right. We just don't know what the issues are going to be. And you put your finger on it. What is Mueller going to come up with? Will Mueller find something so explosive and so incontrovertible that Republicans will peel away from Trump the way they did at the very end with Richard Nixon after the smoking gun tape? I don't know. That's possible, but I wouldn't bet on it. I think it's very likely that Trump will be the Republican nominee and that he'll have the support of the great majority of Republicans.
Brett Stevens, in his New York Times column, he seems to be a big fan of Larry Hogan, the recently reelected governor of Maryland, Hogan has not ruled out a challenge to Trump. Stevens quoted from Hogan's recent inaugural address, noting that while Hogan, who doesn't like the president, didn't mention Trump's name, he sent a signal when he talked about his late father, who was a Republican congressman from Maryland.
He served on the House Judiciary Committee during Watergate, as the whole world watched the impeachment proceedings. Despite tremendous political pressure, he put aside partisanship and answered the demands of his conscience to do what he thought was the right thing for the nation that he loved. Party loyalty, he said, and personal affection and precedents of the past must fall before the arbiter of men's actions, the law itself. No man, not even the President of the United States, is above the law. For our system of justice and our system of government to survive, we must pledge our highest allegiance to the strength of the law and not to the common frailties of man. With those words, my father became the first Republican to come out for the impeachment of President Richard Nixon. Now, that decision cost him dearly. He lost friends and supporters and his party's nomination for governor that year. But it earned him something more valuable, a quiet conscience and an honored place in history.
You know, Jack, he was talking about, you know, 1974 and his father and the impeachment of Richard Nixon, but those words sounded very much like 2020, didn't they?
Very much so. And the problem for a potential Hogan candidacy is the difference between politics in 1974 and politics as we approach 2020. In 1974, the parties were not as polarized today, although Hogan was early in opposing Nixon. He ended up not being alone. There were several Republicans on the Judiciary Committee who supported articles of impeachment. And in the Senate, famously, James Buckley, a conservative party elected from New York, came out for Nixon's resignation, which is ultimately what happened. But in 2020, very few Republicans are taking on the president, and it's not likely that there would be a great deal of support among Republican primary voters. So in the end, I'd be pretty surprised if Hogan were to make this race.
Well, if not Hogan, I mean, and of course Kasich is looking like he's running, does any other Republican name come to mind as a possible candidate? I know that Mitt Romney's already said he wouldn't run, and there's some talk about Ben Sasse of Nebraska, but any names?
Not really. Most Republicans currently serving in office have a record of supporting Trump. Even Mitt Romney on most issues is aligned with the president. Ben Sasse has sometimes been verbally critical of Trump, but when it comes to decisions and voting records, is a fairly reliable Trump supporter. The problem is to make a viable race, you need to raise money. Well, where are you going to get the money from? Not going to get a huge number of small donations from Republicans. And the larger donors are going to be very, very skittish about crossing the Trump administration. So unless there is a Republican billionaire out there willing to run on his or her own, really hard to see how somebody can make a truly effective race in the presidential primaries.
Yeah, as you were saying that, I was thinking, I mean, obviously you can't beat somebody with nobody, but then I was wondering how widespread are the sentiments of never Trump Republicans like Bret Stephens or Stephen Hayes or Bill Kristol that a Republican needs to challenge the president next year?
Yeah, I think a lot of the people who would agree with that are people who don't vote in Republican primaries. There are a lot of people who are commentators and Democrats who looking across the aisle at the Republicans. But within the party itself, there just isn't so far this passion for challenging Trump. It just isn't there. That doesn't mean that Trump is a lock for reelection. The polls indicate that he could be in very deep trouble in November of 2020. But in the primaries, the Republicans seem to be very much on his side so far.
And I guess, you know, since we have no idea what Robert Mueller has up his sleeve, we don't know how vulnerable Trump might be for 2020.
No, and I think Democrats who are assuming that they're going to win next year should think historically that several times in recent decades, presidents who looked like goners in the year before the reelection year ended up winning, and winning by substantial margins. I'm old enough to remember Nixon in 1971. He was having a very tough time, and he ended up carrying 49 states. Bill Clinton, after the Republican takeover, also looked as if he were in very, very difficult shape, came back and won by, again, a substantial margin in 1996. Ronald Reagan, 1983, he was coming out of a very, very deep recession, but the economy turned around, and he carried 49 states. So,
and let's not forget George H.W. Bush, who was a shoo-in in 1991.
And I remember that very painfully because I was working at the Republican National Committee in 1991. But the economy turned south later in the year, and that was that as far as he was concerned. Don't necessarily think Trump is in this position, but we simply don't know what the world's going to look like in 2020.
But I think it's fair to say that a primary challenger may not be as outlandish as it once seemed.
No, it's possible. John Kasich does have the courage of his convictions. He certainly, by standard measures, is very qualified to be a candidate for president, does well in interviews and on television. But the question is, can he get the support in terms of contributors, in terms of volunteers? That's very much an open question.
Jack Pitney is a politics professor at Claremont McKenna College. Jack, thank you, as always, for your expertise.
Thank you.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, who was the first female senator to launch a presidential bid? The answer, Margaret Chase Smith, the Maine Republican, famously known for taking on Joe McCarthy when no one else would, jumped into the 1964 contest.
As gratifying as are the reasons advanced urging me to run, I find the reasons advanced against my running to be far more impelling. For were I to run, it would be under severe limitations with respect to lack of money, lack of organization, and lack of time because of the requirements to be on the job in Washington, doing my elected duty, instead of abandoning those duties to campaign, plus the very heavy odds against me. So because of these very impelling reasons against my running, I have decided that I shall.
Remember the Maine. And the randomly selected winner is Leslie Small of Atlanta, Georgia. Leslie wins the coveted political junkie button. And we have a scuttlebutton winner as well. That's that waste of time contest where you need to take a word or concept from each button I post and then come up with a familiar saying or slogan. Our last contest led off with a button that read Marvel Batchelder, the Republican governor-lieutenant governor ticket from Nebraska in 1974. A Stassen for Us button from 1948, a beautiful picture button of Mrs. Hubert Humphrey and Mrs. Ed Muskie from 1968, one that read, May 14th, vote for the Constitution, and finally a Zell Miller button from Georgia. So when you combine Marvel and Us and Mrs. and May and Zell, you kind of get the marvelous Mrs. Maisel, that absolutely brilliant TV show that is streamed on Amazon Prime. If you haven't seen it, you should. And the winner is Scott Schaefer of Annapolis, Maryland. We'll have a new scuttlebutton puzzle up on our website this weekend. You can find that, as well as our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all at krpoliticaljunkie.com.
It's wonderful. It's marvelous. You should care.
Ask Americans how they feel about political dynasties, and they'll invariably say, it's complicated. They rejected Clinton and Bush candidates in 2016. They love the Kennedys, but that dynasty is not what it used to be. And with Jerry Brown now in retirement after serving longer than any other governor in California history, The Brown family dynasty is probably gone as well. But there is a great new book out on that very subject, The Browns of California, the family dynasty that transformed a state and shaped a nation. It's written by Miriam Powell, a Pulitzer Prize-winning editor and reporter with Newsday and the Los Angeles Times. She's also the author of a great biography of Cesar Chavez. And she's here to talk about Jerry and Pat Brown, among the most significant governors ever to serve in the Golden State. Miriam, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Thank you. Great to be here.
I think Pat Brown's place in history has long been established, solidifying the state's infrastructure, creating new jobs, protecting water resources, fixing California's higher education system. He's widely regarded as one of the great governors of his day.
I think that's absolutely true. It's interesting because when he lost to Ronald Reagan in 1966...
By a million votes.
I mean, he could have been, you know, a real footnote in history. But his reputation, I think, was very quickly rehabilitated, really, because his accomplishments really were so remarkable. And he, you know, was not just a function of him as an effective politician and elected official, but it was also the time in which he governed, which was this enormous time of expansion in California, when California in 1963 passed New York as being the most populous state. And so there just was this appetite for more of everything. And he had such exuberance and enthusiasm about California and was able to really do some of those things he said and establish the master plan for higher education, the water project, the highways, and so forth, that really left a very tangible physical legacy.
You know, you mentioned that when he sought a third term in 66 and lost to Reagan, taxes were high, welfare rolls were growing, crime was on the upsurge, and there was also a growing white backlash to the civil rights movement, and they had the riots in Watts. You know, the farm workers were unhappy, the hippies in Berkeley. And he was fighting with Jesse Unruh and other Democrats. So in other words, again, when you think of him as one of the great governors, and yet when you looked at the ledger, the tally sheet in 66, there was a lot to say negatively about him.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not that unusual for second term, for governors to have a harder time in their second term and to be more unpopular. But the events really caught up with him. He was in so many ways a creature of the 1950s world, his brand, you know, the classic old-style retail politics. We were moving into an era where television was what mattered. Ronald Reagan was a great presence on television. Pat Brown was not. And the combination of the Watts riots and the student movement, student free speech movement at Berkeley, that 1-2 punch kind of really hurt him. And the Reagan campaign always said that the slogan that had the greatest resonance with people, his best line was that he was going to clean up the mess at Berkeley. And that kind of came to stand for the idea that the state was out of control. There were all of these problems that you mentioned that were starting to build, and the backlash to the civil rights movement and the student movement, and those, the televised, you know, footage of cops carrying the students out of Sproul Hall, and Pat Brown sort of equivocating about how he was going to deal with that. And that combined with the Watts riots really gave people this sense that Pat was not in control. And Reagan was able to come in as the outsider in this very kind of, you know, charismatic on TV way, with the promise to sort of reestablish order.
Yeah, it seems like when you mention, when you combine the Watts and the Berkeley situations, it just seems like Brown was not prepared for what was to happen. Maybe he was just so much part of the 50s that he wasn't ready for the 1960s to go.
Right. I mean, the you know, because the other factor which obviously was propelling the student movement as well was the Vietnam War. And interestingly, the Vietnam War is when Jerry Brown gets his first start in politics. He's working on the, you know, in 1968 for Eugene McCarthy in anti-war slate. And he and his father had this very strong difference of opinion because Pat continued to support Johnson. And so that hurt him. He was kind of beset on all sides. The liberals really didn't do much to support him in 66 because they were disenchanted with his support for Johnson and the war. And then he just got, you know, pilloried from the right for all of his civil rights positions. So he lost his base in many ways.
One thing you wrote about Pat Brown stuck with me, and I thought this was very interesting because I just didn't even picture this. You were describing the views of the Kennedy family, but you wrote about the paradox of how Brown could be such an effective, accomplished governor while at the time seeming to be a very weak political leader. I was fascinated by that.
Yeah, and he would say that about himself later, that his weakness was to have not been a stronger political leader, and that really comes into play in the 1960 convention in Los Angeles, which nominates Kennedy, where Pat sort of tries to hold the delegation apart as a favorite son, doesn't endorse Kennedy until later, then can't deliver the delegation because there's a very strong Stevenson component. And, you know, all of this really speaks to politics in California and how different it is from politics in the East and in the Midwest and in many other parts of the country, where there is not a political machine in that sense. And the Kennedys, for example, were always very frustrated that they wanted one person to deal with in California. Why was there a Northern California operation and a Southern California operation? And why couldn't Pat just deliver people for them in the way that, you know, Mayor Daley could or various other political machines? And that's something that is, it speaks to Pat, but it also speaks to the nature of politics here in California, in which system that was sort of set up very much in opposition to that kind of political machine ward style politics. So that was just not going to happen. And it hurt him reputation wise with people like the Kennedys.
I should tell you that the reason I sought out your book was because I was and I remain absolutely fascinated about Jerry Brown. I remember, as we all remember, during the first two terms as governor after he was elected in 74, he was a flake, he was a moonbeam, he was an unfocused governor in the 70s who I think turned out to be a serious, no-nonsense a chief executive and a nationwide leader on things like climate change and immigration. I'm stunned about how they were. You talked about Northern California and Southern California, two different Californias. There's absolutely two different Jerry Browns.
So, I agree with that. I mean, in terms of his governing style, although I think that he's very much the same person always. And there's a lot of things that he's very consistent about, and his basic philosophy, I don't think, has changed. When you ask people who are close to him, and he has a circle of friends who have been close to him for decades and decades, he's still close to kids who lived on the street where they grew up and to his high school friends and so on, you say, well, what's the difference between Jerry 1 and Jerry 2? There are two answers, Ann and Oakland. And Ann being Ann Gust, who is his wife, and they've been involved since 1990, but got married in 2005. And Anne is very much his partner in every way. She's his intellectual equal. She was ran his campaigns and was his chief of staff in the Attorney General's office and in many ways in the governor's office as well, and was able to keep him focused in a way that he was not the first time that he served as governor. And then Oakland, where he, you know, does this bizarre thing to many people of restarting his political career after having been out of office and on the outs for many years. He goes and runs for mayor in Oakland in 1998, becomes the first white mayor of Oakland in 20 years, and really uses that as a springboard to his sort of second political career. And he has talked a lot about what the experience of being a mayor and really seeing problems up close and seeing how laws that are passed in the state impact local government, seeing what the issues are in terms of development, in terms of criminal justice in particular, which was a huge problem in Oakland at the time he was mayor, that really influenced his thinking when he came back into office in Sacramento the second time.
You know, I was thinking of the enemies Jerry Brown made in his later years, because when Donald Trump was elected, you know, he made it clear that his policies would not benefit immigrants or take into account climate change. Brown became a nationwide leader, basically, of the opposition on that, both on immigration overhaul and climate change.
Yes, very much so. And I think that speaks to California's size. I mean, to some extent, the governor of California, you know, is a national and even an international figure, no matter who it is, because California is the fifth largest economy in the world. And, you know, the population of Los Angeles County alone is bigger than 43 states. So anything that California does in a lot of ways can set an agenda. And, you know, I would go back to Jerry One for a second and say that some of the things that he did in the environmental realm when he was governor the first time were very significant and groundbreaking. And all of the early car emission standards, for example, came out of the California Air Resources Board. And, you know, we're having this battle now between the Trump administration and California again over emission standards, but so many cars are sold in California that California has that ability to set a national agenda. And I think what's interesting about Brown the second time is then partly in opposition to Trump, but he has been so effective in using the governor's bully pulpit to advance those causes, climate change, protecting immigrants, and to some degree, talking about nuclear proliferation, although that's, he's had less impact on in that realm. But he has really managed to use that office in a way that, I don't think any other California governor in recent history has succeeded in doing.
You know, I mentioned that, of course, Donald Trump was on top of the so-called, if there was such a thing as a Brown enemies list. But at the same time, Brown also blocked the spending impulses of liberal Democrats in the legislature.
Yeah, he's always been, as he would say, cheap. And, you know, this was an issue the first time around. And, I mean, another significant thing that happened in his first incarnation as governor was that Prop 13 was passed while he was running for re-election in 1978, which was an enormous event and has influenced almost every decision, you know, in California ever since then. And that was partly happened because the state had such a big surplus at the time. And so he has been a fiscal conservative in some senses. He, you know, took small is beautiful. I mean, E.F. Schumacher, that was his Bible in the 70s. So when he came back in, though, there was a much more, I think his vision of being fiscally prudent met with a lot more support because it was coming after this era when the spending had been out of control and the budgets had just been out of whack for so long. So he was able to proselytize for ideas like a rainy day fund and for not increasing ongoing spending to levels where it would have to be then either cut back or, you know, you'd have to resort to fiscal gimmicks. And so he definitely was a sort of a steadying influence on the budget process and on the Democrats. And we'll see what happens now, how much that continues under the new administration. He also left office with a $21 billion surplus, which is a nice gift for an incoming governor to have.
And I think the incoming governor, Gavin Newsom, is probably more committed to spending money than Brown was.
I think that's true, and I think he has a lot of ideas about how he wants to spend it, and they're not necessarily the same as where Brown was spending it, and we'll see how their priorities differ pretty soon.
All in all, pluses and minuses, what's your report card on Jerry Brown?
Well, you know, he was asked this question recently, what grade he would give himself, and he said, I take my courses pass, fail, and I passed. So I think that that's a reasonable answer. I mean, you know, he's had an enormous impact on the state in a lot of ways, and in a lot because California is just so large. There's so many things that have happened even in the last 8 years that, you know, in how juvenile justice was reformed, in the prisons, in the school funding formula, that to some degree are still going to play out, and we'll have to see, you know, how successful they are and how long they last. But no one is going to have a career to match his for a very long time.
Maryam Powell is the author of The Browns of California, the family dynasty that transformed a state and shaped a nation. Miriam, it was great having you on the program.
Great to be here. Always fun to talk to you.
I am Governor Jerry Brown. I aura smiles and never frown. Soon I will be president. Out of power, I'll seek the way. I will be fearer one day. I will command all of you. If it's all fair.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to Ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.